You're listening to Trending with Timmery, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics. National speaker Timmery Millington has been a passionate advocate for life as long as she can remember, helping Gen X through Z answer the call to true feminism and authentic manhood. Timmery holds a master's degree in biblical theology, and she covers this week's hottest stories from a Catholic worldview. You're listening to Trending with Timmery.
The future of abortion is something that we really are going to discuss later on today. There's a major court case coming out of the state of Alabama that could truly see us facing the legalization of personhood for the child in the womb, and therefore the delegalization of abortion across the nation. So more on that fantastic news. I have with me in studio today, Dr. Philip Chavez.
It's good to be here as always, Timmery. Thanks.
It's wonderful to have you. You know, with the current climate of abortion here in the United States, especially post the New York law just a couple months here,
Sure. What
are you getting the vibe of the issue of abortion? General conversation today is?
Well, generally things are, being shaken up. You know, it's interesting, too. There's a lot of talk about unplanned, too. So I think the movie actually in its release comes at a very timely period. But yeah, I think there
is more
awareness.
For those who are unfamiliar, share a little bit about the movie Unplanned.
Yes. The movie Unplanned is a story about Abby Johnson, who, as I understand it, I haven't seen the movie yet. Of course, it hasn't been officially released. In that movie, she's the Planned Parenthood clinic operator. And she actually has to witness an abortion. She has to be present either in some way to assist the doctor because somebody was needed. And she actually sees a child struggling in the womb. And that converts her toward a pro-life position.
Well, and it's incredible because this is actually based off of a book called Unplanned, which tells her firsthand account of her experience moving from being a primary worker in the abortion clinic, a Planned Parenthood Employee of the Year even at
That's
some
right.
points, to suddenly being an ardent pro-life activist because she saw firsthand via an ultrasound guided abortion. So she was watching on the screen as the baby was cringing away from the abortion instruments that were mutilating the child to the point of death.
Yeah, and it's going to be something as the days go by, the months, the years, because now that we have access to this kind of technology, I think people are waking up like they never have before. There's technology now that you can't deny, and with things now in 3D, makes it all the more real. And in this age where people need to see the reality, the future bodes interesting, and I think for the pro-life movement, it bodes promising.
And the future for yourselves and your spiritual life is a very important thing we're going to discuss today because we're in the middle of Lent, and maybe you're not quite starting your Lent yet. You're still contemplating what that thing will be that you work on, or maybe you are in the midst of struggling through your Lenten sacrifices. So we'll be talking about that. But I have a question and I want to hear your thoughts on this. So send us a message at Timmery on Facebook, Twitter, or comment on the live videos taking place right now, because I'm interested to hear why you think Ash Wednesday is such a popular date to go to Mass. You know, it's so interesting. I was at the store the other day and I had ashes on my forehead, and the gentleman, I think it was at Kohl's, said, "Oh my gosh, is it Ash Wednesday?" And I said, "Yes." And I've got to get to church. He starts fumbling in his pocket for his phone. I'm thinking, man, this guy's like a hardcore Catholic who's missing Mass today. And then he goes, "I've been a really, really bad Catholic for 17 years now." Mm. And I was just amazed at this longing to go to Mass, yet this, you know, attitude of, well, I don't go for 17 years. I've been a terrible Catholic. So we're going to come to that because I would love to hear your thoughts. Like, please send me a message. I want to hear why you think that is. And I'll love to hear your thoughts in a couple minutes here. But I want to start today with a story that popped up a couple weeks ago. And probably if you heard it, might have kind of brushed it aside as somewhat insignificant, but it really stood out to me. And that is that former Vice President Joe Biden apologized
That's
for
right.
complimenting now current Vice President Mike Pence. He complimented him basically for saying he's a decent guy. And what followed was shocking. He ended up coming out and apologizing for calling current Vice President Mike Pence a decent guy. And he basically, because Cynthia Nixon, who considers herself a lesbian and an act activist and actress, came out saying something along the lines of, do you know how this falls on the ears of essentially the LGBTQ community? And so he comes back going, Cynthia, you are right. And he says, nothing decent. There's nothing decent about being anti-LGBTQ rights, and that includes the vice president. And I was appalled. Like, forget the political parties here. Why is it we can't even be okay with the fact that we're finding a common ground and complimenting someone?
Sure. And, you know, Mike Pence, I mean, if anybody's watched him on TV, he is a decent guy. And I think what happens is, in this case, the former vice president is just caving into part of the base that he doesn't want to upset. I think it's just that simple. He just wants to accept that. I believe deep down he believes Mike Pence is a decent guy.
And, you know, there's some charm about Vice President Mike Pence. I know he kind of gets a lot of flack for saying some very simple things, such as, I don't go out to eat alone with women who aren't my wife. I'm very respectful of the institution of marriage, the covenant of marriage that I've entered into. And man, people just slam him for saying simple, respectful things. And I think it's pretty cool that former Vice President Joe Biden is able to say, yeah, I've worked with this guy for years. He's a decent guy.
Yeah, he is. And very decent in the sense that he has a very high moral code and he's very proud of it. And I think that inherently is offensive to people who don't hold that.
So why does this affect you? Why are we talking about it on Trending? This is Timmery Jaja. You're listening to Trending with Timmery. That is Dr. Philip Chavez of the Men's Academy, calling men into their mission. And you know, I look at this and I think this resonates so deeply with each and every one of us, because it's natural to kind of alienate ourselves from ideologies and people who we don't like or whose opinions we don't like.
Sure.
Yet it's so familiar. It's a part of the family experience to find that common ground, the basic common ground of, you're my family member, and so I have to like you. I have to learn to love you despite all else. And so when we see conversations of calling someone, yeah, a decent guy, it's kind of getting to the core of even basic civil conversation. When you're having a conversation, you need to try to find common ground rather than just beating your opponent over the head with what you think needs to be said.
That's right. Well, and that common ground, Timmery, I really think is just a sense of goodwill and charity toward another. You know, I mean, there's no real reason, you know, that Mike Pence, or rather that the former Vice President Joe Biden, has to in some way backtrack on this. And he could say, well, look, I really just disagree with his position, but overall, you know, I think he's a good guy. So there's a certain sense of cowardice there that he's not overcoming.
And it's a cowardice in all of ourselves that we're not having a conversation that's relatable so much of the time. We're having a conversation that goes over someone else's head, is maybe pounding their head into the floor. And if we would only listen to where another person is at, we, you know, and maybe, you know, even the actress Cynthia Nixon, I would have had a lot of respect for her if she said, you know what, former Vice President, what do you see is decent about Mike Pence? Because I don't see he's decent because he opposes my lifestyle.
That's right.
That could have opened up a conversation to find that common ground, but still challenge someone where they're at.
Well, yeah, in this case, I'm not sure that Cynthia Nixon is open to common ground. You know, I think she just feels like she's in a marginalized community and that needs to be defended at all costs, and her behavior and what she advocates needs to be justified.
Yeah. Well, and I think that I would have more empathy if we had these conversations, but this is where we have to call on ourselves to have empathy to begin with, recognizing people right where they're at. And I mentioned at the beginning of the show, you know, Ash Wednesday, there's this gentleman at Kohl's fumbling for his phone when he realized that it was Ash Wednesday. And it was so interesting because I looked at him and I have to say, I got this line from Patrick Coffin when he was interviewing Milo Yiannopoulos a few months ago. He, you know, extended this olive branch to Milo at one point in his faith and said, like, man, Milo defends and believes everything the Catholic Church teaches on sexuality, yet he's living a contrary lifestyle.
That's right.
And Patrick Coffin at one point in the interview says, you know, Milo, you are one confession away from complete union and being able to receive Jesus Christ in the most holy sacrament of the altar. And so as this guy's sitting here saying, yeah, I've been a terrible Catholic, I said, okay, what can I say? And I look at him and I said, well, you're one confession away from being otherwise. And it was funny because the lady at the desk was also Catholic, because she commented, yeah, it is Ash Wednesday. And she paused and she looked at me, and he looked at me as if I had just passed kind of this boundary that went a little too far, and he wanted to object to it, but I didn't say anything. I let him respond, and he goes, and kind of nods silently.
Well, the difficulty with Milo, and this is where we have to show a little sympathy in this sense, you know, for Milo, it's not a faith to be professed, it's a life to be lived. And so, you know, within him, there is some propensity toward a same-sex attraction, which makes him or which moves him to engage in a certain behavior and live a certain lifestyle. Now, that for him is second nature. That for him is like drinking water.
I mean,
that
it's deep a habit need. He's been living for so
exactly.
long.
Exactly. So for him to extricate himself from that is very, very difficult. I think deep down, given that he has much of the Catholic faith and it is imbued in him, it's like anybody who may fully assent to the faith, but may have an addictive personality towards something else. They're falling into that, but they still in some way do surrender to the faith, which I think deep down he does. He just can't fulfill it in terms of its lifestyle.
But that's such a testament and a reminder to myself of the power of the gospel. You know, Jesus Christ is calling us. The kingdom of heaven is here and now. Repent and believe in the gospel. Reunite yourself through the sacrament of reconciliation, maybe through a conversion into the church if you're not Catholic, and have the faith that God is going to work with you to change you, to conform you to him with building new habits.
That's right. And I think, Timmery, I think a way to start that is to really try to move with God as a father. You know, no matter where any of us are in terms of our most difficult struggles or difficult sins or whatnot, I think if we move in kind of a communion, interpersonal kind of journey with the Father, say, Father, just walk with me on this. Just show me, just guide me, just lead me. And I think if one learns how to surrender to the Father and walk in a journey and trust and move with him, I think light will be given. Because the Father is most pleased when we come to him as a son or as a daughter. And I think that's when when we entrust him with that, I think that's when he's most willing to send his gifts.
Timmery will be right back. Tweet them at Timmery. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Timmery, where morality and culture meet, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
There's a game-changing court case on the issue of abortion that we're going to be discussing. If you've not heard about it, this is huge, coming out of Alabama. In fact, NARAL, the National Abortion Organization, and Planned Parenthood and other major abortion industry key leaders are terrified by this court case. So that's coming up. Right now, though, Dr. Philip Chavez is with me. I would love to hear, why is it that Ash Wednesday is the most attended day of the year for Mass? Why do you think that is?
Well, I think there is something, I think, about the tangibleness of the ashes. And I think, too, you know, many, when they were growing up, too, that was somewhat of a tradition they want to hang on to. And I think, too, it's somewhat the right time of year, too. Everything's kind of slowed down and everything is kind of at a standstill for most of our lives. You know, there's no great events during the month of March. And so I think this becomes a real event, which surfaces highly. But what I'm finding kind of interesting and in some way cute and I won't say amusing, but just charming, is that now people aren't afraid to show those ashes on social media. And so I've seen plenty of pictures. It's really cute when you see these families with four or five kids all with ashes. So to see that happy display of the faith, I think that become even more contagious now.
You know, and it's interesting to me looking at this. Why is it? And I would love to hear from you. If you're listening right now, please send me a message. Why is it that you like to go to Mass on Ash Wednesday? Or why do you think it is that everyone shows up suddenly? It's like the national day to be a Catholic each year, not Easter, not Christmas. It is Ash Wednesday. Part of what I think it is there are a lot of people who know they can't receive communion. And although there's a lot of disrespect, people are receiving communion in a state of mortal sin. I think for some, it's like, this is something I can participate in, A. But B, so many people who aren't Catholic love our Catholic stuff. They love Palm Sunday and they love Ash Wednesday. I remember growing up, my parents had friends who would say, oh, when is Ash Wednesday? And if they didn't go to Mass, even if they weren't Catholic, they would ask us to get palms for them to have a blessed object within their home. Now, the ashes, I feel like, is one of those Catholic things. And people love, you know, physical, tangible things, like you said, but it's an opportunity to participate in what is so deeply connected to our heart. And that is the longing to worship. You know, St. Augustine says, our soul's restless until it rests in you. Well, here's a material reality of saying, I want to rest in you. I want to be close to you, God. And the symbol of the cross on my forehead with ashes reminds me of, I'm a creature, you're the creator. And although I may live otherwise 364 days a year today, I'm living with you.
That's right. And I think from that, there's a certain embarking on probably the most important time where we can honor the Creator, you know, through whom the Son came and He offered the great sacrifice. And so the Lent is about the beginning of the celebration, or rather the commemoration of that great sacrifice. And so I think somehow people intuitively know that Easter, the Passion, Death, and Resurrection, and finally Easter Sunday is really the apex of the practice of the Christian life. And so Ash Wednesday simply becomes an initiation into that journey, which I think people intuit is the most important thing, or at least one of the most important event that's happened in human history, other than perhaps the Incarnation.
That's Dr. Philip Chavez. You are listening to Trending with Timory. So good to be with you. Shoot me over a tweet, Facebook message. I don't care where it is. Go over to radiotrending.com. Go to the contact page. Tell me, because there's a lot of theories I have, but I want to understand, why do so many people go to Mass to receive ashes on Ash Wednesday? And, you know, you could also say, why do so many people leave right after the ashes and don't stay for the rest of the Mass even?
That's right.
It's a good conversation. But today I want to talk about, where are you in your Lenten journey? Hopefully, and I'm kind of tired of this, it's something I hear very common in Catholic media, and I've talked about this too. Okay, have you even started anything yet? Have you made excuses? You don't know what to give up yet. You don't know what to do. Stop making excuses. Let this year be the Lent where you say, from here on out, I'm going to put it on my calendar a week in advance. Know when Lent starts. And today, this is what I'm doing. No more excuses. Maybe ask your closest relative or friend, what can I work on this Lent if you don't know what to do?
Or you just ask yourself, well, gosh, to move closer in the spiritual life, what's the next thing I need to do? I think deep down, people know that if they're not saying their morning prayers, their evening prayers, that's something they got to get on board with. Mm. And so those are the most vital times to pray. And so I think for most people, I could be wrong here, but it's to get back to a life of prayer where they need to start initiating or resuming the prayers that maybe they had the child when they got up or when they went to bed.
And hopefully, you know, we've kept those practices of praying morning and night. But at this point in our lives, they've expanded. You know, when I was a child, my mom taught us that, you know, now I lay me down to sleep.
That's
prayer.
Right.
Very simple prayer you can memorize. It's a beautiful prayer. But as we mature in the spiritual life, we're called to enhance that prayer. Go further. You know, we're called to an evening of an examination of the day. What have I done that's been good? What have I worked on that's overcome what I've struggled with? And where have I failed today so that I know tomorrow what I can do to amend my life and do better?
Sure. And to supplement to that prayer too, I mean, for most people, I think what really helps engage them in the spiritual life is when they learn to speak heart to heart with their Heavenly Father. And I think this is what our Lord wants of us. Certainly, this is what the saints taught, which they called it mental prayer, but it's part of the Christian practice that, especially as adults, we should be practicing a period of heart to heart prayer daily.
Absolutely. You know, I have to say a couple of the things that I have done in the past that have really changed my spiritual life. And my hope is that, you know, yes, Lent is prayer, fasting, and almsgiving.
I think
a lot of the time we just end up fasting from something simple, such as chocolate or let's say soda. And not saying that those aren't sacrifices, but we need to incorporate all three elements. And if you're giving something up, it shouldn't just be, I heard a priest say it just this past week, it shouldn't be that you're giving up smoking. You should give up smoking because that's good for your health. No, make a real sacrifice, add on to that, you know? But some of the key things that in the past for me, I started going to Mass, daily Mass during Lent as soon as I got my driver's license. And it's a practice I've maintained and a discipline I've developed throughout my spiritual life. Maybe you can't go every single day, but how can you incorporate this in so that you go and you pray the Mass, offering yourself to God each day?
That's right. You know, it used to be in years past where I heard even in the 50s, you know, churches used to be packed for daily Mass. Mm. And so, yes, that practice was a very core practice for Christians in the past.
And you have to remember, we don't get to go to daily Mass. We don't have to go to daily Mass. We get to go to daily Mass. And I think that's the difference in the beauty of daily Mass. You know, we think of Sunday as our obligation. We've talked on the show before about being obliged to do something. It's something, you know, there's a responsibility. But daily Mass, you are giving yourself, you get to go. It's a blessing. It's a gift. And we're called to go and pray the Mass, not just show up. Because, you know, I see a lot of people who go to daily Mass. And it's wonderful to see. But each day we're called to a deeper conversion, to pray the Mass, not to attend it like we get to attend a concert each day. Because attending daily Mass makes you feel good. But praying the daily Mass, making a sacrifice there, that changes you.
That's right. And what we're asked to do as Catholics is to immerse ourselves and unite ourselves with Christ's sacrifice that really is being offered. So when the priests raise the host, raise the chalice, he really raises in some way our body and our blood, and that we're supposed to offer in union with our Savior. In fact, I was reading recently that that actually is what makes our suffering meritorious. It's not just simply the fact that we do it, but the fact that we unite them with Christ's suffering. In fact, if we take on his identity, then in some way all of our sacrifices really become his sacrifices. So the meritoriousness and the glory of it and the efficacy comes because it's his sacrifice, which we immerse ourselves into.
This weekend, I was attending a Maronite Mass in Orange County while I was traveling. I've been on the road every weekend since I've gotten married, except for the first weekend after we were married, speaking at different conferences. Maybe you're a first-time listener today listening to Trending. Shout out to all of you from El Paso, Fresno, up and down the state. My life has been full of airplane rides lately. But when I was in Orange County this past weekend, one of the things that the priest said, Father Anton Bach was talking about, because in the Maronite Church, it's the feast of the cleansing of the leper this past Sunday. And what they were talking about is every year, the first Sunday of Lent. And what Father was talking about was how Jesus, when he cleansed the leper, when he healed him of his leprosy, he said, "Where did the leprosy go?" And he said, Jesus took that leprosy upon himself. And that is what's so beautiful. God takes our sin upon himself, but it's not just enough that he takes it upon himself. He suffers that, but then he leads it and takes it to the cross and suffers even deeper with that sin, with that sickness that he's healing us from. And that's what we're called to go into when we go into Mass. Everything that we're offering, whether it's ourselves, the sacrifices for others, we're supposed to take it and lay it down.
Yeah. Well, that's very beautiful. Yeah. I mean, Christ did. He suffered everything and all he suffered what's inherent in our sins and all the penalty for that. But yes, he did in some way suffer for all the consequences of Adam too. So all the things that men suffer, all these diseases, Christ in some way carried those and took those on to himself. It's fascinating.
You know, we talked about having a good morning and evening routine for praying, and I'm a very organized person. A lot of Catholics tend to be people who are more geared toward organized worship, right?
Yes, I think that's right.
And so what makes you think that you're going to pray morning and night if you don't have some sort of habitual organization to it? And so I want to challenge you a couple ideas. You need to get some sort of book that's going to help you form the habit of praying, a structure to praying. Two ideas I offer is the Liturgy of the Hours, also known as the Divine Office, which all the priests and many of the religious pray around the world every day, the same prayers. And they have, you know, seven times a day prayer, you know, in the morning, midday, you know, mid-afternoon, the evening, before you go to bed. Take it up and you're reading the Psalms. You're reading Old and New Testament. Another idea, and it's a little, you got to play with the book, learn how to use the book. That's a Divine Office. The second is Manual of Prayers. It has a prayer for everything in it. You can get it on Amazon.
Right. Yeah. I thought you were going to say that, well, I list everything that I do, so I'm reminded. And so, you know, two of the most sacred places are the refrigerator and the bathroom mirror. So perhaps this is where I thought you were going, is to write down what you plan to do or propose to do or should be doing and put in those two places as an ongoing reminder.
That's a fabulous idea. And remember, those, you know, markers that you can use on a whiteboard, you can use on your mirror. Use your markers.
Use it
on your mirror. It's fun, whether you're writing messages to your kids, your spouse, or it's a reminder of, I need to learn how to pray. Let's put it right in front of my face every day.
That's right. And those concrete reminders, I think God blesses that.
So a challenge, find three ways to really adhere to those three callings of Lent: prayer, fasting, almsgiving.
Timory will be right back. Tweet them at Timory. That's TIMMERIE. You're listening to Trending with Timory.
Coming up, I'm going to share with you guys a story that was absolutely shocking. A gentleman this weekend who I met, his wife's an OBGYN. He was sharing me the aftermath that she's regularly exposed to with regard to abortion. Something that I had never heard, but then in talking to different friends now, just since then, over the last few days, who are also OGYNs, I was shocked to hear this. So stay tuned, because I really want you to hear this. It's something very important to discuss about the issue of abortion. But right now, there's a show on the BBC put together with Masterpiece called Victoria, and it's walking through the life of Victoria from right before she becomes queen into her marriage and having, I think she's at child number 7 about right now in the show. I've not finished the current season. Have you seen an episode?
I haven't seen it all, no.
That's Dr. Philip Chavez of the Men's Academy joining me right now. And I wanted to bring this up because the show I always find so interesting, because you have a female leading monarch here. Her husband is not able to be king. He's a prince consort, just like the current British kingship, or not even king, but queen, kingship, Elizabeth. Yeah. And then we have the prince consort as well now in the current ruling. It's really interesting because what's happening is you see a lot of male-female dynamic. And with Victoria, it's fascinating both from her and Prince Albert's perspective to see sometimes the emasculation there, the feminization of Victoria. And at one point in the latest episode, and again, they just had the season finale and I've not finished that far into the show, but back in 1847, when the couple is having about their 7th child, what happens is there were some private photos that Queen Elizabeth and Prince Albert had taken of the queen with her children, bathing her children and, you know, holding and feeding her child. And what happened is these private photos ended up being leaked to the press, about 60 of them. And the royal family was incredibly mortified that Queen Victoria would be depicted as a mother, that she would be depicted in a very, I don't know, maybe they'd say matronly way, sure, caring for her child. And at one point in the movie, and I'll post an article of it, shows the pictures that are adapted for the BBC show, but then the actual pictures that were released. And this is what Queen Victoria says, as she's kind of fuming over these pictures. She's asking the prime minister what can be done to punish, you know, the man who released these. And she says this at one point, they're going to see a woman, not a queen. And that just struck me to the core, because I think that that's a statement so many women today say. Well, if someone knows I'm pregnant, they're going to see a pregnant woman. They're not going to see me and my hard work, or me as filling my position in this family, or position in this workplace, or position here. They're not going to see me as an equal. And it's so sad that there's this attitude of embarrassment, not only about bearing children or being maternal, but also about just being a woman.
Well, couldn't it be, Timory, that in this case, what you just pointed out in terms of the pregnancy, in pregnancy, a woman is very vulnerable. And so there's something where she lives a kind of life which is not her own. And she becomes, in some way, a servant to the child, and has to attend to that, and it's very conscious. And so for her, it seemed to be in contradiction for somebody who is in a ruling state. So when you think of a ruler or somebody who's reigning, that's somebody who's strong, who's not vulnerable in a way, who has a disposition to rule, is completely free to rule. And so in showing her in a maternal state, or acting as a mother and dealing with her kids, it probably, in her view, it probably compromises her ability to be seen and respected as a national leader.
Absolutely. And if you watching the show, because I know you said you've not seen it, I don't really expect you to watch Victoria.
Well, I'll have to grab an episode or two.
But what's interesting is, at the same time, her sister and Prince Albert are kind of making comments behind her back and to her that having children now has kind of impacted the way that she's ruling in a way. Maybe she's a little more hot-tempered, or maybe, you know, she's taking a little more emotion to some circumstances. And I'd argue, in some circumstances, her maternal element for her people is part of what makes her such a great ruler at times. But sure, maybe there are decisions she makes that are a little more emotional than she would be making, you know, in the movie, than if she were not pregnant or not have just had another child, and her 7th child. So I think you're correct, but here touches on something, I think, male or female, there's this fear of showing any type of insecurity today.
Well, in this case, I think for a royal family too, Timur, I think there's a natural modesty that they need to have more so. I mean, most of us, you know, when we have a barbecue in the backyard, we really don't want people looking over the fence. Why? Right. We want a certain level of privacy. And so all the more so do we see those for heads of state. In some way, we know inherently it's somewhat proper that they live a more reserved and hidden life, at least in their private affairs.
Right.
Okay, and we could see them being photographed in very public things, and it's something very proper. But to be hidden in private, I think, is proper for those in a higher station of life. The same reason even the Holy Father. Now, you know, even John Paul II, there were certain images taken of him in somewhat a private form, but for the most part, they're not photographed in their day-to-day activity.
And there's a beauty to that. It's about the leadership and the rule and God willing truth that they are pushing forward in terms of their monarchy or reign, let's say, or leadership as a pope, that is supposed to be there, that it's not the person that comes first, but the responsibility. But couldn't you even take that to family life? That it's not just it's not just personally what's going on, but it's also the responsibility of what we're living. And so, for example, a woman in the workforce who's pregnant, she has a responsibility to live and be true to who she is and not be afraid or embarrassed by the fact that she has children, but to take on that responsibility.
Sure. And in light of the queen, it seems to me, too, if she's growing awareness of maternity, I mean, having seven children, she's very much family oriented. She has to be, at least on a day-to-day level. And so hopefully that would give her a sense of implementing things under her rule which would help family life, because that's what builds a good society. Mm-hmm. You can't have a strong society without strong families, and you can't have strong families without somebody understanding the needs of families very well. Now, of course, I would imagine the family needs of a queen is much different from the common person, but at least you can understand the needs of children and things that need to be tended to for strong families and ultimately a strong society.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a good testament. I love, because what you're saying about this privacy in the personal life, I think that's important in general in life. Even in the show The Queen, which has come out through Netflix, it's been neat watching The Queen, which goes through Queen Elizabeth's life, and now Victoria, that goes through Queen Victoria's life. And I mean, you have almost a 150 plus year gap essentially here. I mean, less than that, really. Yeah. Only 100 years in some ways when they start their reigns. But it's interesting to look at, because they have this level as female monarchs of this level of duty. And yes, like you said, this privacy in terms of their personal lives that's meant to come forth. And I think that they show such a strong level of responsibility that they've taken on. And that's what I think, like I said, is so beautiful about the story. But also, you still have to have an element of being true to who you are and not being afraid, oh, I am a woman still leading. You can't deny who you are. And I think then when we begin to hide that, that's when we run into issues of gender ideology. We've got to say there's no difference now, because to say there's a difference is to say that you're weak, or to say you're vulnerable, or to say that something wrong, or to stereotype.
Well, in this case too, Timur, I think there's an added difficulty that when you are in a position of ruling, you know, there's an example that you have to set, and there's something about the common good which you have to make higher than your own private good. So inherently, you know, a queen with children's put in a very difficult position, I think, overall. And so, but yes, I think what you say is right. She nonetheless has to be true to herself and has to figure out, and which would be a struggle. How do you manage putting on the disposition, the demeanor, the comportment, the presence of a queen, yet at the same time put on the disposition, presence, comportment of a caring, nurturing mother? That would be difficult.
But isn't this a challenge for most women today? So many women are in the workforce, fully in the workforce, and outside of the home, and there's this constant frustration, guilt, fear, anxiety that they're living and measuring up to what they're meant to, both in the workplace and as a mother at the same time. I think Queen Victoria's struggle shows the struggle of the modern day woman, really.
That could be. Yeah, that could be. And and in this kind of thing, you know, it's very difficult for women to manage both. And so, again, I think, you know, in light of the first part of our segments here is that, you know, this is something too. Again, I think they just need to listen or lift up in prayer and offer this to the Father to find those answers to how they should be living.
There's a fundamental court case coming up that we're going to be discussing about the future of abortion, that Planned Parenthood is terrified as this will play out, coming out of Alabama. Meantime, I was traveling this weekend and a gentleman came up to me and shared with me his wife, who's recently retired OBGYN, as an OBGYN, would often discover in her work with women and their anatomy the remains of aborted babies very regularly in their work. Cause of infection, cause of maybe infertility, or cause for other women's health issues down the road. And she would actually end up removing the remains of the abortions that had taken place in the past. Now, I have two perspectives on this. One, from the perspective of the health of the woman, any leftover remains from an aborted child in the woman's body is very, very dangerous for her health.
Mainly because of infection, probably. Right?
Mainly because of infection. So this is scary to hear, but it's also something we know that happens. In fact, an abortionist or in his workers actually are supposed to reassemble the child.
That's right.
Now, what I thought was so interesting, this man, I believe Filipino, was sharing that his wife, it really just broke her heart in her work, finding these aborted baby parts, and how often if she would find multiple parts, it's like she would actually put the babies back together as much as possible, and they would actually have a burial and find a burial place for these children at burial grounds. Man, it just wrenched at my heart, a perspective I had never heard. OBGYNs are having to find the remains of aborted babies. They're then just so impacted. They're putting the baby's body parts back together and burying them. And I looked at him and I said, I'm so sorry you had to go through that. And he was almost in tears. He said, thank God my wife is retired now. It would break her heart. But I looked at him and I said, you're performing a corporate work of mercy in burying the dead here. That is so good, and although so painful to experience, so healing for the brokenness of the culture.
Well said.
Timory will be right back. Tweet them at Timory. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Timory, where morality and culture meet, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
Dr. Philip Chavez is in studio with me. I was just telling the story. If you missed it, please go back, head over to radiotrending.com, because you need to hear the story about a man whose wife is an OBGYN and the experience they went through in her work. And the medical industry, the healthcare professionals, the aftermath they see from abortion that they don't talk about because it's so shocking. Is something, stories we need to hear more often. But with that, I want to mention Dr. Leanna Wen is the new president of Planned Parenthood. And she came on record. She was doing an interview just over last week, and she was talking about how unethical and unconscionable it is essentially to, quote, direct interference with a practice of medicine. And she was saying, how could you even conceive the idea of interfering with abortion essentially as a medicine? And she said, this is about lives and health. And she said, this is not care. And it was just so shocking to me that she's so upset over the Title X funding policy that says, no, we're not going to fund women's health clinics that provide and refer for abortions. But that's how healthcare should be. Abortion isn't a disease to be treated. And so when she's saying it's unethical and unconscionable and bad healthcare, those are some great talking points. I hope we're not dumb enough to believe them or we're able to converse about this.
That's right. I mean, you know, when you talk about medicine, the end of medicine is to bring health to the body. And abortion is the exact opposite. In fact, I wouldn't know what would be the opposite of health or bringing health through medicine, a butchery? I'm not sure. So it's more proper to speak of abortion as an act of butchery, not as an act of bringing health.
Absolutely. It's just so shocking. So I bring this up because Planned Parenthood right now is scared, which is why they've actually brought in a medical doctor to be the face of Planned Parenthood, a medical doctor who's also an immigrant. And so she's using some really great talking points. You've got to pay attention to what she's saying. Watch her interviews, pick them apart, because these are the exact arguments that pro-abortion supporters or people on the middle ground are using to defend their apathy over abortion or their outright belief in abortion.
That's right. And you'll notice in the argumentation generally, it's not about inherently, intrinsically something about the child. It's more about a woman's right and her right to choose, which their position is their right to choose trumps the right of a child or an unborn child to have life.
Well, and that's so true. That's what we saw in the New York abortion law, and we're seeing New Mexico and other states all over the country saying we need to have abortion through all 9 months of a woman's pregnancy. And OBGYNs are coming out saying there's no reason that a woman, for her health, needs to have an abortion in that last trimester, possibly an early delivery that could be detrimental for the child, but not an abortion.
Yeah. And if it were, it'd be an extremely rare case. But yeah, again, the abortion industry sees abortion as an absolute right. So everything that infringes upon that should be pushed away or mitigated.
Absolutely. I want to come up. I've been talking about this all day, and that is about the court case that is truly going to change the future of abortion depending on its outcome. So the state of Alabama in Madison County, we're seeing a young man,
19, I think.
Yes, 19. When he was 17, he and his girlfriend conceived a child, and he took on the responsibility of the fact that he was going to be a father and got another job to start supporting this child. And the young lady, and against his will, the young lady ended up having an abortion and aborted his child at about Alabama Women's Center. She had an RU486 chemical abortion. And he has filed a lawsuit, and this is the key. The judge has actually accepted the lawsuit. He's suing on behalf of himself for not having any say in the fact that his child was aborted, and second, on behalf of the child, who is a person under the Constitution of Alabama, because they recently, just last year, passed an amendment of personhood for the preborn child.
Yeah, because after the declaration that life begins at conception, then you have to in some way declare personhood. And so if there is a real person there, that person does have rights. Mm-hmm. And that person would, again, this all just follows in progression, that person would have rights in the womb, which are defensible.
So Ryan Majors has filed this lawsuit on behalf of himself as a father, having rights to keep his child alive, and his baby. In fact, a baby whose life will never have the opportunity to be lived because the baby was aborted. And so while he's fighting this lawsuit, it's for the future of children and fathers. So the lawsuit is filed against the abortion clinic, which is Abortion Alabama Women's Center, against the abortionist who performed and prescribed the chemical abortion, and also against the pharmaceutical company.
That's interesting, yeah.
And so this is actually a first of its kind, at least here in the state. Now, here's the key thing. Different court cases have been attempted, lawsuits to be taken on in the same situation. But what's key here in the state of Alabama, it's a first of its kind, especially because we see the personhood amendment that was enacted recently there in Alabama. So what that person amendment says is basically the preborn child has the same rights that you and I have, but also that there's no right to abortion and that there is no requirement to fund abortion in their state.
Interesting. Yeah, so in this case, boy, the ramifications are huge. Once you declare that there's really truly personhood here and that has to be in some way followed through, it's going to be an interesting battle moving forward in the pro-life movement.
Yeah, the abortion movement is terrified. We're seeing NARAL, Planned Parenthood, and other pro-abortion organizations saying this is scary. Like, outright, you can look at their tweets. They're terrified with where this will go. Pray for this young man, Ryan Majors, that he doesn't choose at any point to give up, because the enemy, and I say the enemy of Planned Parenthood, the pharmaceutical company, will be coming after him, but also spiritually. This young man is going to be persecuted and experience great spiritual warfare as this progresses.
And I think what's noble about this young man, he must be quite a human being, because he said too, he says, really, what I really want to do too is uphold the rights of all fathers. So he sees this not just about himself or his own child, but really about a cause that's bigger than himself.
His story is so powerful. And you just see, not that I'm a huge fan of tattoos, give it or leave it, but he's got a tattoo and he has the due date of his baby on the tattoo. And he's not too emotional and breaking down in his interview, but you hear the power and the conviction in him over the loss of his own child.
Yeah, he must be an incredible man. And I think we have to pray for him. All of us do. And we have to pray that he stays steadfast, as you say, and fights temptation, which, as you can imagine, too, will not only be coming on things that he experiences tangibly, but I'm sure even the underworld will be after him very vigorously.
I want to encourage all of you to participate in a 40 Days for Life campaign. Even if you just give 1 hour this Lent, maybe you can give one a week. There's a 40 Days for Life campaign, which is where it's praying and fasting for an end to abortion, but also doing it on the sidewalk in front of the abortion clinic. You can sign up with a friend at 40daysforlife, I believe .com, possibly .org. I think it's 40daysforlife.com, and sign up to be a prayer warrior. And I'm going to tell you a little story. So in fact, very closely related to the story here. I had spent some time traveling to Alabama back close to 10 years ago now, because in the state of Alabama, there was an abortion clinic where essentially there were 4 pro-life sidewalk counselors who would stand on the sidewalk counseling women, and they saved many, many lives through their intercession. What happened was, a number of years ago, these 4 sidewalk counselors were jailed and punished for being on the public sidewalk. In the end, I don't think anything really came of the court case fully, but what happened is it scared all prayer warriors and all sidewalk counselors across the street. And then once they were across the street, some of them stopped going. There were a few that regularly went. So I worked with an organization at the time, and we went out and we established a prayerful presence in front of the abortion clinic. So as all the pro-lifers are praying across the street, we went in risking arrest, standing in front of the abortion clinic on the public sidewalk to reestablish that you can indeed pray and counsel here. Well, what happens is they started bringing the pro-life presence back in front of the abortion clinic.
Okay.
Within 2 years, that abortion clinic closed. That is the power and life-changing impact of praying in front of the abortion clinic and sidewalk counseling. It's a testament to the lives that are being destroyed and telling those women and fathers that we care about you, your souls, and the life of your child.
Yeah, and I want to encourage people too, as you've probably seen too, Timory, with the 40 Days for Life, you'll see that the prayer warrior is just increasing. So when I was at the abortion clinic this last Wednesday, the number had increased. So this really is a time, if I can use the word, to jump on board with trying to become more active, because it's a time I think you can get the most support for getting out there and putting yourself on the front lines there. And there is such a journey of introspection when you're in front of an abortion clinic. I still feel this as a man. I mean, there's emotion that goes on. There's like your sense of God, your sense of evil. And there's such a deep, profound, internal awareness about something that's happening within. And so I just find that there's such an opportunity for great spiritual awakening and a lot of personal transformation.
Absolutely.
Just being in front of the abortion clinic.
Absolutely. It challenges you to live the cross. To live sacrificially, to live and speak up for the vulnerable, to live and speak up for the sinner, the oppressed.
That's
absolutely
right.
I want to give a shout out to anyone listening. Maybe you have a high schooler. This June, there is the Vox Vitae Camp for teenagers. Now, it's 5 days of education on what their Catholic faith is. There's adoration, confession every day, mass every day. We have a full day on pro-life apologetics. We have a full day on chastity education, pornography. So much of the current issues that young people are struggling with. You can check that out at voxvitae.org. I'll be one of the speakers along with Pam Stenzel, Doug Barry. We'll have Matt Walsh there. And there's an evening series for adults after work if you're interested over at voxvitae.org. Dr. Chavez, what's going on with the Men's Academy? Where can people find your upcoming events?
Well, they can find them at themensacademy.org. I'm looking forward to a day-long conference we're going to have on May 4th, Restoring Genuine Manliness. It'll be a 3-hour session in the morning and a 3-hour session after lunch. Basically, in the beginning, the first day, part of the day, I'll be speaking mainly of what I call the 18 pillars of manliness to gain a strong foundation of that. But in the afternoon, I want to help men with certain ideas on how they can live a life heart-to-heart with their Heavenly Father. Because most men have a very difficult time, most Catholics, working heart-to-heart with their Heavenly Father, moving in that.
Check that out at themensacademy.org, calling men into their mission.
This has been Trending with Timory. To learn more about Timory Millington, visit timory.com.